From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I won't give anything away, but here's the plot for Jonathan Lethem's latest novel. A handsome backgammon hustler who believes himself to be telepathic is afflicted with a tumor that will change his identity. If you read Lethem, the book will be kind of familiar, but you'll also get a sense of how his work has changed over time. Last night, we talked to Lethem about his writing and his life, and we're broadcasting that conversation today. For those who don't yet know his work, he's one of the MacArthur geniuses. Newsweek named him one of the 100 people to watch this century. You can read his stories in The New Yorker. We talked with Lethem about growing up in a crumbling New York City in a kind of hippie commune, how he made the transition from visual art to words, and how he never, ever goes back and rereads his own books. Jonathan Lethem today, after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jonathan Lethem says he's never gone back and reread any of his books, though he remembers everything about them. He says he wants to remember them not as a reader might, but as the writer. It's that sensation of writing he says he wants to preserve. His first books had this dreamlike quality, but he was careful not to include references to actual culture like real movies or real music. He didn't want the books to seem topical or dated. But with his breakout novel, Motherless Brooklyn, something started to change. He decided to include in his work the things that had always mattered to him, like comic books and punk rock. By the time he gets to his autobiographical novel, The Fortress of Solitude, he's packing his writing with the artifacts of his life, like references to real cities with real street names. His latest novel is just out. It's called A Gambler's Anatomy. We talked with Lethem last night at the Masonic Temple in Salt Lake City. He was here for the Utah Humanities Book Festival. We're going to broadcast that conversation today. We started by talking about this crucial time in Lethem's life when he really started thinking about culture. It was that time between the ages of 13 and 17.
I mean, I can account for the intensity of those years in a very particular and personal way. My mother began to be sick with brain cancer when I was 11, and she died when I was 14. So whatever might be typical or generic about the intensity of that passage, for me, has this kind of, memory black hole at the center of it, which intensified things in very particular ways. But I do go back again and again to the sort of talismanic cultural objects that I picked up in that period, and perhaps most particularly when I was 14 and 15. And also to friendships that I made in that period, which I'm very happy to say many of them continue, but even those that don't are still sort of objects of contemplation for me. So the people themselves were like books or movies to me at that point. They confounded me and nourished me and became objects of study and compulsion. You know, I think of myself as a very compulsive person in my appetite for narrative and cultural stuff in general.
The thing you said was that your life has been, speaking of that idea of compulsion, a compulsive sequence of engaging with the premises that came out of the novels and the comic books and the films and the records and other stuff that you were encountering. What were the premises, though? Was there a sort of a something that tied them all together in some way?
Well, let's see. So to paint the sort of backdrop, I grew up in a very culturally rich household. My father is still a painter and was working in our house, and his studio was part of my life. I was in and out of it all the time. His friends were artists and painters and poets, and my mother's reading life was extremely active, and I was drawn to it, magnetized by it, and I would read books that were too advanced for me. And their record collection was astounding. It was great. I could never be as cool as my parents.
Right.
But I think, of course, somewhere around age 13, 14, what I needed to do was define stuff that was my own in some way and get out from their sphere. even though it was a very enriching one and very influential one, I also needed stuff that in some ways signified against their, what they regarded as stuff worth paying attention to. So by getting into, kind of American vernacular culture, pulp fiction and comic books, and then very conveniently for me, punk rock was sort of invented right at that moment when I needed a rock and roll of my own.
Yeah.
I couldn't listen to my mother's Cream records anymore. So I had something to kick back with, And so this constellation of stuff, in retrospect, of course, it's not really a break with the world I came from, but it was different enough.
It was your own.
It was my own. I could pretend that I was breaking out of that world, even as I was in many ways extending it.
So maybe we should also explain, sort of give a landscape setting for, you grew up in the 60s and 70s in New York, which it's way different from New York today.
Yes.
What did you describe it once as it was a fallen city in those days?
Yeah, it's very hard to believe how much that place had spiraled. But I mean, on a literal level, it was bankrupt and many vast sections of it were sort of, redlined. You couldn't get a mortgage because no one thought it was a safe bet for you to buy a house in regions of Brooklyn, like the one that I grew up in. And it was a kind of a beautifully juxtaposed place. It was culturally super valent. There were all these artists everywhere doing things very freely, living very easily in this kind of dystopian social landscape. And so it's become mythologized. And I, for better or worse, I was really a product of that space. And there was always this sense that, yes, you were inhabiting a kind of, in a way, a crumbled empire. It was a great city once. Too bad about it now.
You've talked about feeling, this is how you put it, dispossessed of the primary American identity.
Yeah. Well, I was raised by leftists and by artists. And I was raised in a kind of glamorous poverty among people who just made it seem like that was the best way to be.
Yeah.
It was very slow to dawn on me that we were actually poor, that going to, get my glasses free from the Department of Health was not how, most of the white kids were getting their spectacles.
It was like a commune in some ways.
Yeah, and the house was also, it was built around my family at the center of it, but there were always extra personalities around.
Yeah.
My parents, my father's students, or just political radicals who were floating through town and needed a place to crash, and then suddenly 6 months went by, and sometimes a little bit later on it was kind of an official communal household with cooking nights and dish nights, where us kids had to pretend to be at the house meetings and play our equal role, and that was great. I mean, it was all spectacularly interesting and enriching for me, but it did not make me suitable for, identifying with most of the ways that, that even the kids I went to college with when I finally went to a private school in New England for college, it was the first time I'd been out of public school. And this, it was a pretty hip school, but I was from another, in a way I was like a time traveler.
Yeah.
For me, the 60s didn't end until 1982.
Right. I want to ask about your mother, who is this, sounds like this great sort of social political activist. And you talked about how one of her great gifts, maybe her great gift, was her memory, her sense of recall. And this is what I liked about what you said about it. You said that it wasn't like she had a photographic memory, but she had this memory that you described it as centering on emotional situations and languages. Like, what's the difference? What is that?
Well, it was contextual, and it was it was oriented towards meaning, human meaning, what you cared about. It was narrative making. She story told her friends and her family's life in real time. She was making legend. She'd nickname you. She'd burnish an anecdote out of an evening that was still in progress.
Wow.
She was just, that becomes a superconductor for memory. It makes you remember things. So the people around her loved her for the way she made them feel, memorialized in daily life, remembered and enshrined in something bigger than themselves. And you know, I think she was a kind of a writer without a you know, paper and pen.
You said she was 36 when she died.
Yeah.
And you've said that you thought that maybe she could have been or would have been if she had lived a writer. Do you think so?
I don't know. I've said it, and I don't know whether that's my own myth,
yeah.
my own way of, my own sacred myth about my origins.
Yep.
I do remember that there were at least a couple of moments where I heard her friends say to her that you ought to be a writer. And it would be the most natural remark to make about someone as verbal and magnetic and as I say, as prone to kind of making stories out of people's lives and telling them, reminding them of things that were important about themselves. On the other hand, she was, unlike my father and unlike me, I think she was phobic of solitude. She would never have gone off into a room with a typewriter and disappeared for hours and then days at a time to write things down. She really lived in the social arena. So that's my reservation. I'm not sure she ever could have been attracted to the solitary life of the writer.
So she was diagnosed with a brain tumor when you were 11. She died when you were 14. Did that memory, did that recall, did it go away with the tumor, diminish?
Oh, in the very last part of her illness, after there were two surgeries and the second was unsuccessful, it was an 11th hour attempt to deal with a resurgent tumor. And she was damaged by that second attempt. So it wasn't even a question of merely memory. Her verbal and motor functions were diminished. And then there was only 5 or 6 months left in her life at that point. But until the second surgery, she was weakened, but her brilliance and the intensity of her emotional life and her demands and charisma, all of those things were intact.
Your father, as you said, was a painter. And I was wondering, I wanted to talk about how it is you ended up being a writer and not a painter.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that you've done, and you've even talked about you were a sculptor. You did sculptures in marble. What were they like?
Well, I was just trying to make sort of classical Greek marble statuary.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
I just wanted to I was so obsessed with the craft, and I was just fantasizing about, you know, Michelangelo and other, you know, Renaissance or Greek stone carvers. I wanted to be able to, you know, carve the curl of hair at someone's temple. And so it was just, for me, it was all about the craft. I didn't want to impose any modernist conception of what art should be onto this practice. I wanted to just make really beautiful statuary.
Yeah.
It would be easy to exaggerate how much of this I did, but I had the luck of being an art student very early on. I mean, first of all, I painted at home, and that got me aware of the fact that I'd inherited some facility. I could impress grown-ups really easily with my drawing and my painting. And that got me into a special public high school in New York City called Music and Art, and sort of became famous or notorious as the Fame School.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed the very most natural thing for me to continue to do what I was getting so much good attention for, and that got me out of math classes, basically. I spent my entire senior year of high school carving stone, right?
Wow.
But the truth was I was always too interested in narrative and time and language to feel fulfilled within the purely, you know, plastic visual arts. Even though, of course, contemporary, you know, visual art encompasses a lot of language and concept. But I didn't think I could do what I wanted to do there. I was such a voracious reader, and I loved film so much and comic books so much that I knew I was leaning to making some kind of story, and that was really where the action was going to be for me.
But it wasn't. It's interesting, as you didn't. It wasn't necessarily your first option to write. I mean, you've talked about how there was kind of, for a while, there was this happy medium where you were like, maybe I'll make films,
yeah.
or
Well, I was aware of the pleasure I took in visual stuff, and I loved comic books and films fervently. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, the thing to do is to locate myself in this exciting juncture where there's visual and narrative and language all together. And I did try to draw comic books for a while, but I didn't have the patience to draw the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
It's a very monastic practice. You know, we think of comic book artists like R. Crumb as these sort of, you know, wildcat characters, but really you're sitting there just doing this incredibly disciplined thing to make your character look the same in 100 panels, you know, day after day. And I was too much of a impulsive, expressive artist to do that well. And filmmaking requires being a really good collaborator. And I turned out I'm a little tin dictator. I do not like to delegate parts of my creative world to, like, you know, the actor. You know, I just was impatient. The few times I tried to do anything except make an animated film, I made 3 animated films, and then I tried to direct humans and have a, you know, a cameraman and actors, and I was absolutely insufferable. So I went to the art form where I could be the you know, I could cast the entire story myself, and I was the cinematographer, and I was the set dresser, and, you know, a novelist really is God.
But it's great how you've talked about also the first stories that you were writing, the first short stories that you're writing, the first stuff that you're doing wasn't all that great from your perspective.
Oh, no, it was, well, I mean, I don't think this is that that uncommon. I think the reverse would be uncommon, to be good
right away
stories and novels quickly.
Yeah, but
instantly.
When people are not so good right away, they give up. You didn't. You stayed with it.
Well, I had two things. I had great confidence in my creative identity.
Okay.
If I declared one, it seemed to me I should be allowed to practice it. That seemed to come with my family, you know, with kind of the DNA.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize that was unusual. I felt very willful and defiant about my ability to work, but I didn't think that was so special until I realized, I talked to other writers later on and realized how much work they'd had to do, emotional labor, really, to carve out the identity, to feel entitled the way I felt automatically entitled to spend their life making these sort of useless things. You know, we live in a very egalitarian society, and there are a lot of messages that float around that you should practice some, you know, some form of labor that is productive and also that you not be antisocial. And artists are suspicious characters because they make things that are not utilitarian, they have no value, and they go off into these secret corners, and they're sort of creepy. But I was not socialized in that common way. When I speak of not having the kind of typical American, ethos, I felt no awkwardness or shame or reluctance to assume the artistic identity. And it really was a surprise to me when I realized how hard people often had to kind of battle with, if not their parents, then with the imaginary parents in their head, to say, I'm going to do this thing, you know, against all the odds, I'm going to not be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, but I'm going to do this thing. So I had that. I also had the fact that I was no good at anything else. I hadn't taken math classes. I was not a very diligent student in any particular regard. And so I thought, I've got to do it. I'm going to stay with it and be good.
There was this thing that you wrote. Your mother gave you a typewriter when you were 14. It wasn't long before she died. And you wrote this, I don't know if it was a novel or it was an essay or... It was kind of long, more than 100 pages, I think.
Yes, I wrote a novel. No,
called it a novel.
Yeah.
Hero. Was this Heroes?
It was called Heroes, after the David Bowie song, which had nothing to do with really the tone or the content of the book in any way. I was like, that's a great title. I'm stealing it. But it was. I'm gonna say what it was predicated on, which is really going to sound so pathetic. It was a attempt to cross-fertilize Arthur C. Clarke and Richard Brautigan.
Wow.
And it was a story about the first balloon trip around Mars, which in some way, of course, the reason that Arthur C. Clarke's stories are good is that they're scientifically credible, and I didn't have any capacity to flesh that out. I was totally trying to hoax the reader with the the science fiction aspect of it, and then the travelers were like crazy bohemians like you would meet in trout fishing in America. Now, this sounds like a really good idea for an avant-garde novel, but it wasn't meant to be an avant-garde novel. I was really thinking that was like a really cool novel that people would really want to read it kind of sincerely on its face. And I was probably trying to write about grown-ups. You know, there I am, 14. What kind of grown-ups do I know? Well, they all reminded me of the characters in Richard Brautigan. So I couldn't write about the scientists and astronauts and engineers that would have been the typical population of a Arthur C. Clarke novel, even though I wanted to. I wrote about hippies instead.
Because you knew hippies.
Yeah, there they were.
Exactly.
Jonathan Lethem speaking to us last night at the Masonic Temple in Salt Lake City. He was here as part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. His latest novel is A Gambler's Anatomy. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting a conversation with the novelist Jonathan Lethem, recorded last night. He was here with the Utah Humanities Book Festival. We talked about art and politics, his writing, and of course, how his life has influenced all of that.
It's interesting, the thing that you've talked about after your mother's death, what you were left with was this sort of sentiment of morbidity, a kind of morbid view, is how you put it, of existence. And your mother dying just sort of cemented this. Look, before your mother died, you were a fatalist anyway, right?
I think so. This has been a study for me to kind of try to grapple with how I understood this giant and very terrible event in my childhood, or towards the end of my childhood. And one of the things that's really puzzled me, disturbed me in some ways, but also really interested me, and it's been an area of, you know, your own mysteries are your greatest source as a novelist of, the imponderables that can keep you exploring new ideas and emotions and trying to model what you've gone through, trying to create these sort of little tableaus or set pieces or dioramas to say, what is it to feel the way I feel about life? And, you know, I began by writing dystopian literature specifically. I wasn't honestly qualified to write science fiction as I just described. I also wasn't genuinely interested in it. It was just the area where, 1984 and Philip K. Dick and J.G. Ballard lived. So I said, okay, well, that's my area. It was dystopianism that I was into, and it's partly because I lived in New York City, which was truly, at that time, a kind of dystopian reality. And it primed me to see world history and American history as I grasped it, the Cold War, the nuclear fear, the kind of stuff that, let's say, Rod Serling had transmuted into the atmosphere of the Twilight Zone. I identified with this stuff totally. A hard rain's going to fall. I was really a product of Cold War fear, and that was also hanging in the background. So I also think, in retrospect, it took me a long time to clarify this, that I had we've talked of my mother's charisma and power, but I had a grandmother, her mother, who was an enormous force in my life and a very dark one.
Yeah.
Really just a very, very dark character. Brilliant, and her disappointment was bottomless, and her pain was bottomless. And her primary message to me growing up was twofold. You're Jewish, but we're several generations removed from the faith. I failed to believe in God. Your mother never even tried. It's never going to work for you. So you're a failed thing. You have an identity that's crucial, but but it was blown on your behalf by your secular family, and we're all just helpless to fix that because we're too smart to believe. So sorry, kid. And you're Jewish and they're coming to get you. And that the central fact of the identity was that the Holocaust had occurred to us and was probably going to be reenacted somewhere soon. And I absorbed these things almost preconsciously. this kind of disappointment and apprehension. And so that's also in the mix. So when my mother fell ill, and this was also concurrent with, weirdly, you know, it's like some sort of overdetermined thing, but it was concurrent with a lot of the disappointments surrounding her own ideals. The counterculture was, you know, crumbling into contradictions, and the pushback, the Reagan era, you know, glamorization of capitalism was coming to kind of crush a lot of what she believed in and worked for. So she was dying. Her world was kind of dying in a certain way.
The city around them was dying.
The city was a problem zone. It was like a you know, a slow motion catastrophe. And I said, at a certain level, I think, yes, and now this too. This confirms my suspicions. You know, what Rod Serling and Kafka have to tell me is true. There's going to be a big black hole at the center of things. And so my mother's death didn't contradict a kind of a sunny worldview. It confirmed, you know, a lot of my apprehensions. Now, that sounds like I was really very gloomy kid. The fact is I was very exuberant. I found the world really magical. I found cultural stuff really magical. My family life was really, you know, diverting and rich and strange and fun. And I was someone who was geared in reverse in some ways. Having your darkest fears confirmed freed you from pretending.
Yeah.
I felt my imagination was loosed. And, you know, and when I encountered a writer like, say, Philip K. Dick, who acknowledged chaos and then laughed at it a lot, I felt, this is how I'm going to live my life.
If people want to come to know your mother and your grandmother, just read Dissident Gardens and Rose and Miriam.
There's a lot of
them in there.
A lot of the portraiture. I was finally ready to pour a lot of them fairly directly into those two characters. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned compulsion. There's also, it seems like there's a bit of obsession. You have obsessions with things. And one of the things I read about recently was you were in a used bookstore and you came upon this book. I'm not sure how long ago this was. Robert, was it Musil? Is that how we pronounce it?
Musil,
okay.
Yeah.
Robert Musil. One of the things you've said is that is one of the ways that you kind of educated yourself in the past, is you just sort
sure.
of boop, take a book from the shelf. And but this Musil book, which I know nothing about, A Man Without Qualities, I'm not sure if he even finished it.
It's, like, it's unfinished.
It's massive.
It's already 1,400 pages long right. and unfinished. And, I mean, not, it's not even necessarily half finished when he tails off.
But you really took to this book.
Yes, it was a really great encounter for me. You know, I mean, these become more precious. You know, we were talking about age 14, 15. I was finding a new favorite writer every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, now it's Catch 22. And wait, look over here, there's Patricia Highsmith. And now, you know, and it's and Vonnegut and Kafka and then, you know, Calvino. And every one of them overturned my world. But to have a, you know, in my 50s, my early 50s, or late 40s, I guess, when I encountered The Man Without Qualities by Musil, to have such a titanic influence come along, it's something much more precious. Because I'm so formed and hardened, and I you know, have mostly intuited what I feel and think about a lot of things. But his sensibility is just extraordinary, and he turned out to be a great lens for looking at contemporary politics too. He's this incredible seer. I mean, he predicts our current situation 1,000 different ways, I don't know if I can ever write a book that emulates Musil directly, but he sure does raise the bar in certain ways for just how much the novel can contain.
So what's the story of finding the book, though? I think as I read it, you had picked up this book and you said, here's a book I'll never read.
Yeah. Well, it was that
I... that told you what? Now I must read it.
One of the things that is true for me is I worked as a bookseller starting as a teenager, and I lived in used bookstores. And it means that you have these kind of promiscuous encounters with books that you haven't read. You're constantly handling them and evaluating them and trying to figure out whether they're worth keeping on the shelf. And, you know, it dovetails with my interest in the outré, in things that no one else is looking at. You know, I used to come to this point when I was running the used book section at Moe's, where I, you know, there's a code on the that we've written in pencil that indicates how long the book has been there, and then you cut the price in half and you leave it up for another couple of months, and then a book would have to die. You know, it had to leave the section because no one wanted it, and I could either put it under the stairs where we would send things off to, you know, some sort of book. You know, where they would melt them into glue.
Book graveyard.
Yeah, book graveyard. Or I could take it home and read it. You know, that's that. When it came to that impasse, I could decide that I was the person that it was meant for. Wow. Since no one else had taken it home. And, you know, that process led me to, I got a lot of cred when I would, say, be the first person to be reading Don Carpenter, and I would tell everyone, you got to read Don Carpenter. And now, you know, he's back in print, and I've loved this process of rediscovery.
Jonathan Leatham, we recorded the conversation last night at the Masonic Temple in Salt Lake City. He was here as part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. His latest novel is called A Gambler's Anatomy. We'll take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Jonathan Leatham, recorded last night at the Masonic Temple in Salt Lake City.
I want to ask about politics and Amnesia Moon, which I know, surely you've gotten this question lately. So there's this world that you create, of course. There's a young man named Chaos, and he's living in this movie theater in Wyoming, in post-apocalyptic Wyoming, in fact. And it goes off on this adventure, and it's this world where there's a TV soap opera star, and they're also political leaders. Like they've merged those two ideas, politics and entertainment. And it seems like the presidential election, at least one part of it, right?
Well, you know, allegorical stories like Orwell's 1984, or like the kind of science fiction that was written in the 1950s that satirized the advertising era, you know, I mean, or even, you know, The Twilight Zone, the kind of writing that Rod Serling did and he and his writers did for that show, is usually the best way to actually capture the absurdity of consensual social or political reality. Because writing about it directly looks farcical. It looks broad and foolish. If you'd invented Trump in a realistic novel about 2016, people would have rejected it as too broad a satire. It wouldn't have had any of the real flavor of the perplexity and the sense of complicity and the sense of seasickness that you experience at the fact that this is what's actually happening. Right. It would just sit there. Oh, yeah, right. So the guy who was this TV star and is unbelievably boorish actually gets the Republican nomination. And it would just sit there and you'd sort of feel superior to it. But when it's written in allegorical form, you can capture, ironically, by being much less realistic, you can capture that seasick, uncanny sense of complicity and disturbance, the estrangement that we all feel from reality, because this is our reality.
You talked about it as the political process, something that comes from our subconscious, and I wanted to ask you about this. Like that it comes from mythology and fear and desire, something buried deep down, like a dream. And I'm not sure I understood what you were getting at.
Well, I don't think I mean anything much more complicated than that. In our relation to these people on our TV screen who are either meant to inform us or lead us or, you know, bridge the two, these sort of pundits and stuff, that we are really in the grip of emotions, the subconscious, collective and individual yearning and dread, as much as we're making these sort of very lucid judgments that we like to tell ourselves are where we're centered. You know, I would say the same thing about most everything. I think by now, for instance, I'm just thinking of this because I was hearing an interesting NPR conversation with Alain de Botton, I'm not sure how to say his name, about how people choose their spouses in uncanny ways and then have to face the fascinating procedure of learning what they, in effect, what they meant by marrying, that it's not something that's clear to you when you do it. You abide with the marriage and you gradually understand it. I think that many people are ready for that insight about, you know, at least if they've had a few relationships, let's say. They're ready to consider that their subconscious lives are really driving a lot of what they experience. But I think collectively we like to think, well, but nations make lucid decisions and pick presidents based on a kind of, you know, scrupulous judgment. You know, we're all thinking this thing through, but I think, in fact, collectively we're prone to dreaming and fear and impulse.
I want to ask you about Motherless Brooklyn, which is this kind of astounding book. And, of course, for those who don't know, it has as this central character, this detective who has Tourette syndrome. And I wanted to ask you, one of the things you've written about and you've talked about was that you had to, as you were writing about it and learning about it, and I wonder if, like, you did a lot of research about this, which seems, you've also talked about you didn't used to do a lot of research. And I wonder if this was kind of unique maybe in the way you did, but as you found yourself, as you were researching this, almost, obviously not actually, but almost catching Tourette's or sort of mastering Tourette's.
Yeah, I would go further and say, I mean, people use the word spectrum very freely now, thinking of disorders on the autism spectrum. Yeah. I would be, without any scientific authority behind this, I would be prone to believe that there would be also effectively like a Tourette's spectrum. And I think, really, almost as a kind of flash of recognition, the moment I first read a really compelling account of what Tourette's syndrome was, which was, of course, in Oliver Sacks, he writes about it twice and both times very brilliantly, I felt that some part of my own brain had been reached into and identified. Now, that's very different. The people who are Tourette's sufferers, and, you know, suffering is the right word for it, are grappling with a life trajectory that's very challenging, and I don't claim any of that experience. And to the extent that I gave it to my character, I was working as a fiction writer. But I do think that the way I identified so totally with the inversions of language and the kind of compulsive reworkings of certain ideas and emotions that really made me need to write that book, I was locating some part of myself that was, you know, vibrating on that level.
He wanted to name things.
Yeah, well, I was... And
that was big for you.
This whole idea of touching and naming, that the two things are similar, and that you make your world by reaching for it and finding it's, you know, almost like a mime with his box. You need to know what the space you're in consists of. But that you might also do that at some level with language, that by throwing words and language and names... I mean, here, we just spoke of my mother and how she would make an evening into a legendary story as it was occurring, right? So it's the compulsive filling up of the world with language artifacts. It was part of what I identified with.
I want to talk about A Gambler's Anatomy. Where did you start? Like, what was the first thing? I mean, I know one of the things you've said is that you have collected stories about gambling. You do a little bit of gambling yourself, not serious gambling, but some...
Barely any.
Nickel poker or something?
I played nickel and dime poker games with college professors, and believe me, those guys can be bluffed with... 50 cents is a big deal to them. They're in the kitchen getting another beer the minute you do that. So, but I do love gambling in stories. I like games in general. I mean, I've always played board games.
Oh, really?
For 5 minutes when I was, you know, 12, I thought I was really good at chess. And then some other kid came along and humbled me. But I still remember feeling like I was going to be a chess whiz, you know. And I kind of gave that to a character in Dissonant Gardens, in fact. I like the way gambling stories create a world of artificial stakes that replaces the real world. It's like a world within the world, a microcosmic scene or arena, you know, because while you're in the casino, while the bet is down, everything else disappears, you know, or when you play an all-night poker game or, you know, and it always means a little more than you want to admit. It's about fate and it's about who you are and what you deserve or what you, what kind of punishment you secretly need to experience. And I think that I just knew I wanted to find my own version of that and write one of those tales one of these days. It's just, for me, it had a lot of narrative juice in it.
How did backgammon come into it?
Yeah, well, I also needed it to be peculiar and my own. You know, I couldn't, for instance, write about poker, which is the one thing that I kind of have gambled at, because poker's on television and it's so disseminated and just seems, it didn't seem like it belonged enough to me or anyone. It didn't have a... it didn't seem opportune. But when I learned, kind of by chance, that someone I knew growing up had for a while made a living as a backgammon hustler, I just grabbed onto that. It seemed so strange and funny. And, a thing that, as I've experienced going around on a book tour, I have to keep explaining to people is possible and real. They think I've just made it up. It seems so sort of dorky that you could do this. But in fact, it goes on, right? People gamble seriously and lose lots of money and can be hustled at backgammon. And I liked backgammon for the different kinds of things that were ambiguously packed into it. You know, it's a very simple game. It's a race. So you can understand what's going on really easily. But
you said it has candidness, I think.
It's very open.
Yeah,
yeah,
open.
There are no hidden cards.
Right.
It's also very ancient. It goes all the way back to like Mesopotamia, but it sort of never has a dominance. The way chess is exalted as this kind of, you know, brainiac thing, or, you know, seems like a very powerful symbol in human society, backgammon just sort of putters along. And in fact, it's has a slightly seedy glamour to it. I think a lot of people associate it with the 70s, and you can kind of picture a couple of guys in the Playboy mansion by a fireside with a bottle of amber fluid and an interesting backgammon problem open on the table between them, you know, which in fact reflects the fact that it had a weird high point. Backgammon waited a really long time for its moment in the sun, and it was the 1970s. It had been lurking since Mesopotamia, and that's when there was a backgammon craze that swept the world. And so a lot of people bought sets then and learned to play. And so it had a bunch of odd signifiers that I liked.
Alexander Bruno is the main character, of course, and he's raised by Bohemians in the 60s and 70s. There's a bit of you in there, I suppose, although not as much.
He's not a particularly autobiographical character, but I did want to write about someone who was much more than I ever successfully did or even ever tried. Someone was running away from a point of origin that was confusing and overripe. And so I picked a kind of confusing, overripe place to be from that I knew a lot about.
You've called Bruno the most beset character you've ever written. A disaster of self-deception. Where did he come from?
Well, I have a kind of strange interest in superficiality in characters in fiction. You know, characters who are obscure even to themselves or aren't even interested in introspection. I wrote a novel from a point of view of a character like that in Chronic City. The main character of that book, Chase Instedman, was a former child star who just kind of coasted through life on past celebrity and his residuals from, you know, having basically been, you know, kind of Michael J. Fox, but never bothering to have a grown-up career.
Yeah.
And he's, I think I'm interested in the way in which ourselves can be made up of other people's projections as much as from the inside out. And so Alexander Bruno, the gambler, is very much one of these. He's tall and handsome, and he's turns out to be good at backgammon. It's like his entire human project is almost like a trick of the light. He just gets by on spare parts and on other
and
people's
good looks.
And good looks and other people's impressions of him and his strange ability to induce fascination in others, which is never rewarded by his being terrifically interesting or deep. He's fascinating without having anything to be fascinating about. And of course, this is a very bad prospect for middle age. It's all destined to go into the gutter. And so that's sort of what the book is about. And I accelerate the process.
I was going to say, you accelerate
very,
it.
You know, to yeah. a great degree with his, he has a terrible medical crisis that pushes him towards all kinds of mortality.
Maybe we shouldn't say too much about that.
Maybe that's where we leave it.
Good. Okay, good. This was something that I had referred to in the introduction, that you don't go back and reread your books, that you want to. Is that still true, by the way?
I've never done it.
Okay. And I want to get at what you mean by that sensation of writing them, that you would rather remember the experience of creating that character, the experience yeah. of working out something. It's almost like it would almost ruin it if you read it again to figure out how you had figured it out.
Well, it's not that I'm afraid of ruining it, but I mean, first of all, I feel that I remember them very completely.
Yeah. Is this your mother's recall?
I guess I do have I'm lucky.
Yeah.
In powers of memory, knock on wood. Let's hope I remain so. But I also can't see anything very, I can't really see a winning move to talk in terms of games. In reading the books, either they're going to be a little better than I remember or fear, and I'll be patting myself on the back continuously, which is just not a very attractive position to be in. You know, hey, that's pretty good. Or if I think it's so much better than anything I could do now, I could get very depressed, right? I could say, oh my God, I was smarter then. So that's terrible. Or even worse, I could find them inadequate. And then I'd be embarrassed at all the times I'd, you know, talked confidently of my accomplishments or signed books for people. I'd want to go out and pulp them all, and you guys wouldn't like that, right? So I just think, what's supposed to happen in that scene? And on the other side of the ledger is the memory that I might potentially be displacing, which is a very precious memory to me, which is the memory of being the person who wrote them, of the situation of figuring them out on a daily basis. And for each of the books, there are at least, you know, two or three very vivid memories of, you know, kind of like problem-solving epiphanies, just getting it, like seeing it locked together, or clarifying something that was obscure, realizing what I meant. And those feelings that's, you know, one of the most precious parts of my life, and it's a lot of my life. So if I turn myself into a reader of the books and I nudge that feeling out of the way in favor of, like, oh, what are they really like to read now that they're finished, I think that would maybe be a great loss.
I guess Bob Dylan was one of those important cultural touchstones for you.
Yeah, terrifically valuable for me at many different points in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not calling the Nobel Committee back. She's, I don't know if that's petulant or just great. I mean, what do you make of the, I read this piece in the New York Times, in fact, Adam Kirsch, who says it's not unlike It Ain't Me, Babe, the, you know, his song, where he basically is saying, you know, take me for who I am, don't make me for what I'm not, and I'm not inclined to call you back, so you shouldn't be surprised by the fact. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's
or the fact that he got the Nobel Prize as a,
it's all pretty amazing. Yeah. I have to say, I sort of feel like I'm standing to one side. It seemed very natural to me, and I was at first really disconcerted by the controversy. You know, my colleague, Claudia Rankine, the poet, great contemporary poet, happened to be on the radio that morning, and it was one of the first things I caught. She was on for a scheduled interview, not knowing that we'd all wake up to Dylan winning the Nobel, and she said, she was asked, as a poet, do you approve? And she said, of course, his words are in all our mouths. And I just thought that couldn't be a more simple way to attest to what he meant, has meant to writers and everyone. And that is just it, and that the simplicity of that to me preempts and transcends all these arguments about category and, you know, oral versus written literature or song, you know, that or whether rock and roll is somehow disreputable. It just his language reorganized so many brains worldwide at such an enormous level, to such an enormous extent over a period of, it, you know, at least the first 6-7 years, and for me, and I think many others beyond that. And I know that writers were among those who had their brains reorganized, you know. So I didn't disapprove of it at all. And then I was disconcerted, and then I had to start to take all the controversy really seriously. And I thought, this is pretty great, actually. It's like he's gone electric again, or he's gone Christian again. Yeah. He actually still can wreck everything and make us all freak out.
Yeah.
And I thought he had been too thoroughly gentrified for that to happen yet one more time. So I was really excited about that. And I just think everybody is right to get upset, because we should be upset about art and language and literature and about Dylan one more time. And so then, talk about like a chess move, he saw that when this argument settled down, that was it. It's done. I mean, there's no greater capstone, right? He's really been graduated through the ceiling, and there can be no more gentrification. So what's the only way to protract the problem is to not accept it clearly or not acknowledge it. So he's stretching out the weirdness on all our behalves. I think it's a great gesture.
Jonathan Lethem. His latest book is A Gambler's Anatomy. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Dylan Everill and Dave Lemon of the Salt Lake Masonic Temple. Thanks also to Weller Bookworks, Lane Richens, Catherine Weller, and Tony Weller. House audio last night was mixed by Aidan Miller. We had support from KUER's Kate Hatley and Tim Slover. KUER's engineer is Lewis Downey. Adrian Moranville mixed the show. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.